our guest in economic papers and also someone who has he's written outstanding books on the Indian economy and the Indian state. And today we have him as our guest. This is a little bit of a role reversal. You've interviewed me. We worked together with the Prime Minister's office, etc. And today I have you here for just a direct conversation about things that are happening in the world. Tell me, you've been known by many different attributes, but one important one was the work you did as a media advisor to the Prime Minister. And when you worked with the Prime Minister, Dr. Manmohan Singh, you were his speechwriter as well. So just take us into that role. How did that function? How did it happen? It's been a long time now, but just to revive the sense and the nostalgia of how it worked.
Well, thank you, Mr. Khurshid, for having me here. I've been watching your discussions and I must say, you're taken to this role like fish to water.
Yeah. You don't know what's happening in politics. You have to look for other professions.
Yes, you know, I had this task to do speech writing. And it was kind of trial by fire. In fact, I joined the Prime Minister's office on the 2nd of June, 2004. I think Dr. Singh was sworn in about a week or 10 days before that. And I had to quit my earlier job and join. The day I joined, Dr. Manmohan Singh called me and said, you have to write my Independence Day speech. Sorry, before that, reply to the President's address.
President's address.
New session of Parliament was to start. And the President's address to Parliament. Never in my life had I ever imagined that I would be asked to write the President's address to Parliament. So it was a complete, you know, shocker. So I said, sir, what do I do? So he said, well, you go around, talk to all the joint secretaries and the PMO and, you know, whoever you need to and take their advice and see what has to be done. And then, of course, next was Independence Day speech, which I wrote. The thing about writing a speech for the Prime Minister is, first of all, Prime Ministers make all kinds of speeches, unimportant, important. They, on a weekly basis, I would say there are at least two or three speeches that a Prime Minister makes. In fact, in the 5 years I was with him, I wrote more than 1,000 speeches. But they are of different importance. I mean, there are some which are routine. You're inaugurating some power station somewhere or a thermal plant somewhere. You know, the routine stuff, the ministry sends a draft in. The really important ones are, one, his statements in Parliament, which he used to take very seriously. Parliament speeches often would be overnight, because he would want to say something in Parliament next day. And the thing about Dr. Singh, unlike most politicians, is he wanted everything in writing.
Okay.
You know, I think there were very few occasions when he spoke extempore, when he just stood up and spoke. Even if he did stand up and speak, he felt comfortable having a text. So he would call me and say, no, I have to speak on this, put together. And with time, I learned enough.
Let's just put it into a structure. You have a big event, you have a major event 3-4 days later, etc. And you're putting your thoughts down and you have to prepare that speech. At what stage would the speech be done, or would you be working on it till last moments, etc., etc.? How did it pan out? And I tell you, when I first started in Mrs. Indira Gandhi's cabinet, I was a speechwriter. And I was a speechwriter for international events. And so I would not know about anything till... So somebody would do one draft was done at the ministry level. Then that would come to the Prime Minister's office level. Then they're the expert at the Prime Minister's office level. Arjun Sen Gupta and people like that were there. Then they would work on that draft. G. Parthasarathy would work on the draft. And then finally it would come to me so that I could present it to the Prime Minister. But did it change? I mean, things were still the same when you were writing it.
Well, I would say there are three different paths in terms of speech writing. First was what you described, that a draft would come from a ministry which was organizing an event, and that would be first seen by the relevant joint secretary in the PMO, who would then send it to me, and I would see it and clean it up, often clean it up for English, more than anything else, given the kind of drafts that used to come from the ministries. And I would then give it to the PM, and you know, he more or less would read out. These are routine event speeches. The second was the slightly more important ones, where he wanted to make a point, whether, as I said, whether on farm loan waiver or on the nuclear deal. A lot of speeches in Parliament on the nuclear. There, I would interact a lot with him, because it was his thinking that went into that speech. There was no draft. Nothing would come to me. I would go to him and he would say, look, this is what I want to say. And then I would take notes. And then I go back and type a draft, go back, and then he would look at it. So it was basically between him and me. The third was kind of landmark speeches. I mean, his address to the U.S. Congress. That was something I would imagine took at least almost 2 months prior to the event, and several people were involved. Jaishankar, who's now the foreign minister and at that time was joint secretary handling the U.S., he would have a draft. Montek would work on it. I would work on it. We'd show it to Ronen Sen in Washington, who was our ambassador. The NSA, Mr. M.K., Jain Dixit in the beginning, M.K. So several people would look at a text, and this would go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth till the last minute.
Interesting. Now, you've written extensively, but there are a couple of books that are very important. And I think that one book is The Accidental Prime Minister, which became a film and so on. And it's been debated extensively amongst various people. Some have been very supportive. Some have questioned the reasons as to why a book like that has been written. But tell us a little bit more about, so to understand from the author exactly what the purpose of that or the intent of that book was.
You know, Mr. Kulshed, I've spoken about this quite a bit. The reason I wrote it, the trigger, was, you know, there was this incident at the Hindustan Times summit where Dr. Singh was asked to speak. And in the middle of the 2G controversy, when the news was all about telecom, and Shobhana Bharatiya went to invite him. And I was at that time editor of Business Standard, which is a different newspaper. And Dr. Singh told Shobhana Bharatiya, I will come to your event and speak, provided Sanjay Baru is chairing that session so that he can control the questions.
Okay.
To me, it was a huge vote of confidence. But that set me thinking. I had left PMO by then. I mean, 2009 I left. This was 2012. 3 years. Does he still need someone outside to defend him, to protect him from questioning of an audience? Actually, that was a trigger. And that was the day I said, I think I need to start writing. I wrote several columns which were critical of the party, but supportive of the Prime Minister. So during that period, since I wrote all these columns, and he knew I was writing these columns, they were in the newspapers, but I would still go and see him. I would still write speeches for him.
Oh, you were? You were still? Okay.
I would still write speeches for him.
Okay.
In fact, the last speech I wrote for him was the speech he gave at the press conference in January 3rd, 2014, the last major press conference he did. I got a call from Vikram Misri, who is now the foreign secretary. He was then PS to PM. Vikram called me and said, look, PM wants to see you. And I went and saw him. And he said, addressing a press conference, this will be my last press conference. I want you to write the opening statement, which I did. So all those incidents convinced me that a book defending his record had to be written. It's a different matter that it was read very differently initially, because I was critical of the relationship with the party. So I took the view that he had been shortchanged. He didn't like my writing it. He was quite annoyed. I know that he was annoyed. He expressed his annoyance at my writing it. But I did think somebody had to put it out, and that's how it did.
Now, your latest book, I think it's your latest book, The Secession of the Successful. Now, that is addressing another critical dimension that hasn't really been commented upon as much as it deserves to be. And that's the migration of the Indian billionaires moving money and themselves abroad off to various tax havens and so on. Now, what is it that you'd want to tell us about that?
Well, first of all, it's not just about wealth, the migration of wealth of billionaires. It's also the migration of talent. So I look at a phenomenon which is essentially of elite migration. And the elite are both the talented Indians, the doctors, the engineers, the scientists, you know, the bright Indians who are studying at some of our best institutions and going out. And the numbers are just rising. They've been rising from the turn of the century for the last 25 years. And more recently, particularly after 2015, you see, and much more after the COVID crisis, a lot of wealth leaving the country. What are called high net worth individuals. You know, literally several thousand millionaires have moved their wealth out of India. Many big business have set up family offices outside India. So I address this question, what is happening? You know, first of all, I ask the question, why is it that we are not talking about it? Because if you go back and look at the literature, the last time Indian economists addressed this problem was in the 70s, when Jagdish Bhagwati famously wrote about brain drain.
And so on.
Yeah. There's huge debate, etc. We have now made it almost like a routine thing. In fact, now people even say, oh, there's no brain drain. People are going, people are coming. You know, it's a natural thing. The world is open. It's not as simple as that. It is true that people are going and people are coming, but the numbers going out is far more than the numbers coming back. And the investment going out of the country now, the latest data shows that the foreign investment made by Indians overseas has exceeded foreign investment coming from outside to India. So there is a new phenomenon, and I think we need to address it. So that's the book.
And you describe this as a situation of non-returning Indians rather than non-resident Indians.
Absolutely.
So what does this mean? But the impact of these people elsewhere in the world, the Indian diaspora, and the extent to which they are able to influence India's point of view abroad, how did that all work out?
See, first of all, the early migration was essentially of working class.
Working class.
Right? What we now see increasingly is of the elite. And a large majority of them, in fact, I would imagine a dominant majority, have emigrated in order to settle down. So they become citizens of other countries. We have been pretending that, no, they are part of us. You know, this the diaspora, the attitude of the foreign ministry has been that this is an asset. So India's soft power. It's good for India that so many people are living outside. We get foreign exchange remittances, $130 billion. So we have normalized a phenomenon in this country. And everybody has come to accept it. And I think the point I make in my book is we should stop seeing the diaspora as an asset. It is a liability. Because these are people who could have stayed in this country and contributed to the development of this country. They are now contributing to the development of other countries. And I think I blame ourselves for having normalized it. You know, we don't see anything wrong. We think that people are, you know, it's a good
But
for
you
that.
Think attitudinally, the responses and reactions one is getting in the Western world would leave them with a sense of comfort in the years to come? Or would there be questions about their choice being right or wrong?
Well, I think this question has come up particularly with Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies and to a lesser extent anti-immigration in Europe, which has not yet been targeting Indians as much as Africans and Muslims. But the fact is that Indians are also now target. I mean, Indians, I mean, both Hindus and Muslims have now become target of anti-immigration sentiment outside. So far, there are other countries people are able to go to. So you feel uncomfortable in the United States, you go to Canada. You feel unhappy in UK, you go to Germany. You know, options are there. And some countries are actually inviting Indians, though the language barrier is an issue. Japan wants more and more Indians. The Japanese are desperately seeking more Indians to move to Japan because there's a need for younger
Taiwan
people.
Seeking Indian Taiwan. Workers, yeah. Yeah.
Taiwan entered into an MOU with us. But problem in all these countries is language. We go typically to English-speaking country.
Now, on the other side of people who are leaving India, etc., is this proclamation of Atmanirbhar Bharat, Viksit Bharat by 2047. Is this just a pipe dream or is there something that substantively supports this proclamation?
You know, at the moment, it's a slogan. I would not say pipe dream, because even the Chinese are dreaming. You know, they have what is called the China dream. But I think the problem with all of this is the effort at the moment is not adequate. You just look at the numbers, whether it is Make in India, whether it is creating talented Indians at home, retaining talent at home, the quality of manpower. The effort at the moment is not adequate. So there is this dream, there is this aspiration. But what does it take? In fact, Monte Aluwalia made a very good point in a speech he gave in Hyderabad, where he said that, look, the average rate of growth of the economy in the last 25 years has been 6%. If you want to be a developed economy by 2047, then over the next 20 years, the average rate of growth has to be 8%.
8%.
How do you jump from 6 to 8? It's not that easy. It took a lot of effort for us to kind of move up to 6. Now, to go from 6 to 8 requires effort. And I think my criticism of whatever we are doing at home in India today is that the effort is inadequate. There is effort. I'm not saying there's no effort.
And what does the West Asian crisis do to all this?
I think it's a huge shock. It's a huge shock. It's a huge shock for a variety of reasons. It's not just an economic shock. I think it also raises questions about our judgments. So there is it's a shake-up. I mean, I don't know. I can use the phrase wake-up call because I don't know if we have woken up, you know, to the realities of global challenge. But the world is becoming a more and more difficult place.
Now, let's come and let's talk a little about BRICS, because there is the BRICS summit this year and we are heading the BRICS, etc., from 5 countries to 11 countries. But there's Quad as well. What is, in your mind, is the role that BRICS can play, and has it sufficiently played that role given these crises that we've seen in the world in recent months?
You know, Mr. Khurshid, I think that there are now a lot of what are called plurilateral organizations, of which we are a part. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, ASEAN Plus 6, BRICS, Quad. I mean, several of these groups are there. And each of these groups was formed in a particular context and is evolved according to the circumstances. It had a certain resonance when it was first formed, but I find now it's no longer having that resonance. Same with BRICS. BRICS, when it began, was essentially seen as Russia and China reaching out to the developing world, which was South Africa, Brazil, and India, and trying to get focus within the G20 on issues of interest to the developing world. And I think I would look at BRICS essentially as a counterpoise to G7, that here is a group of countries which are not happy with the international trading system, international monetary system, international money payment system, etc., intellectual property rights system. So they come together to articulate a certain opinion. Now, of course, the West has seen BRICS as an anti-West thing. It's not anti-West as much as a balancer, you know. I mean, after all, we do have G20. Why did G7 not close shop? It didn't close shop because they have common interests. And I think, therefore, there is need for another counterpoise to the G7, which is the BRICS, right? And expansion of BRICS has happened because there are more countries which have these common interests, you know, and particularly after the Russian-Ukraine war, when the West imposed financial sanctions, you know, weaponized finance by, you know, limiting the restriction to SWIFT and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, essentially used their financial clout to hit at Russia, cutting off Russia's ability to export oil, etc. The weaponization of trade, weaponization of finance, weaponization of energy by the West further reinforced the need for some forum that articulates the interests of the non-West. And I think BRICS essentially is that.
You think that with all this happening and the kind of things that went here about what can happen with currency and trade, ultimately, the attempts that are being made to replace the dollar for some trading purposes, etc., the bilateral deals being made for trading between China and countries in the Middle East, etc., or West Asia, and similarly about Russia using ruble and so on. What is the picture? Can we get an idea of what the picture is?
Well, at the moment, the picture is one of a gradual transition. The pace at which this transition will happen is not clear to me. But certainly there is transition. There are multiple currencies in play today, whether it's the ruble or the yen or the euro. You know, different currencies have acquired a higher profile in international transactions, especially in trade. And I think the dollar's importance has marginally declined. I still say marginally, because as long as oil is priced in dollars, it will remain an important currency, because ultimately it's the petrodollar system that has kept the dollar up. Tomorrow, if actually oil trade moves to non-dollar currencies, that will be a major blow. In fact, the whole attempt of the United States to get countries like India to buy from countries that sell oil in dollars, whether it's Venezuela or the U.S. itself or Saudi Arabia or the Gulf, and not buy it from a Russia or a Iran, is essentially to prop up the dollar, to ensure that oil trade continues in the dollar, right? So they are protecting the dollar. And the dollar continues to be a preferred currency for a large number of countries. But the role for other currencies is growing. And certainly Russia has been able to sell oil with rubles, and the Chinese are now buying from the Iranians in yen.
So
other currencies' role is going, and India is increasingly doing trade with rupee. You know, the number of countries willing to trade with India in the Indian rupee is also increased. So you have a gradual transition. The pace at which this transition will progress is still not clear.
Okay. Now, since we have a captive Russian audience, and you as the secretary of FICCI were very committed to B2B trade and enhancement of trade with Russia, etc. Where are we today in Russia in terms of our political profile with them? Where are we in terms of trade with them, 68 billion, etc., that we have reached now? And what is the future that you see for them?
You know, I all keep arguing, and you've been a foreign minister, and you know this better than anybody else, that a bilateral relationship has three dimensions. There is government to government, people to people, business to business. Government to government, as far as India and Russia are concerned, has been strong right through. I mean, under different regimes in India and under different regimes in Russia, this relationship, the government to government, has always been strong. What has been weakened over the years are both the business to business and the people to people. In fact, in 1991, as I mentioned in my book, Russia was one of the top three trade partners. 16% of Indian trade was with Soviet Union. And it collapsed within 2-3 years to 2-3%. It took a long time to recover. So actually, recovering that relationship is important, and to move away from defense and oil to other products. But people to people, again, when I was a student, I mean, lots of Indian students went to study in Russia. Mm-hmm. You had the Patrice Lumumba fellowships and all of that. That has almost stopped. Now, I'm told there's a revival, in particularly in medicine and engineering. But I think we need much more people-to-people interaction between the two countries. And this has to be a governmental effort, both governments. I believe tourism to Russia now has become very easy. It's affordable. But, you know, I don't know how much it is being promoted. But I think movement of people and of business between the two countries is required in order to restore balance to the relationship.
So with your vast experience, your knowledge of the world, your study of power, both globally and within the country, if in short I just asked you, where would you like to see India? And where would you want India to go? What is it that's possible? What can India do beyond the slogans, beyond the dreams, etc.? But in a concrete terms, if you were to decide to take India forward, where would you want us to stand?
Well, frankly, I would say, first of all, just stop what we are doing at the moment, which is the kind of divisiveness in society, weakening us internally. And this grandstanding that we have done internationally is suddenly exposed when the entire world took Pakistan's version of events in Operation Sindoor. And we had to send some 50, 60 members of parliament.
Yeah, I happened to be one of them. It was a tough job, I can assure you.
All of you had to go around the world convincing the world that we have a story of our own, which is...
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it was a turning point. Sit back and ask, why did the government have to put in this effort? Why could a simple statement of the prime minister convince public opinion internationally? So there is a problem. Recognize the problem. And so get back to the basics. I mean, just focus on education, focus on urbanization, on infrastructure. Forget about what the world thinks of you for a few years. I narrate this to say that let's not worry about how the world sees us. Let us first worry about what we are doing at home. That will change the way the world sees us.
Well, I think I just hope that people who don't have problems are listening in and are watching what you've said and would be helpful for them, as indeed for the whole country, for taking us forward. Thank you very much, Sanjay Barua.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Delight talking to you.